Talkback with William Crawley on BBC Radio Ulster.
In just 21 days, Donald Trump has swept through American and global politics like a tornado, demolishing conventional politics in his wake, from Canada to China, from Mexico to the Middle East. Is he about to turn on Ireland next? And given what he's said and done already, what should Irish and Northern Irish politicians say to him if they get through the doors of the White House on St. Patrick's Day? That's our top story this lunchtime. We'll also take a look at the new report published today, estimating that inquiries, inquests, investigations and other responses to the legacy of the Troubles has cost the UK government more than £2 billion. That is a lot of money. And some will say you cannot put a price on justice, while others will say you absolutely can and you must. Let's get your view on the show today. Then after one, we'll be joined by the Palestinian ambassador to Ireland with her response to the US president's latest comments on Gaza, which he has described as a property development opportunity, and his statement last night, which has worried a lot of people in that region, that in his plan, the people of Gaza will not be allowed to return to their homeland.
Call us on 03030 80 55 55, text 81771 or email the programme talk.back@bbc.co.uk.
Donald Trump arrived in the White House just 3 weeks ago, and in that time, he has taken a wrecking ball to the departments of American government, shutting down every one of the government's ethics watchdogs, closing America's international aid department. He has threatened traditional allies with tariffs, launched a trade war with China, suggested he might send troops to take over the Panama Canal, trolled Canada with his plan to make it America's 51st state, declared that he wants to take over Greenland, and he has announced that he wants to own Gaza, remove the people of Gaza from their land and prevent them returning. And he gets visibly excited at the potential property deals to be done by turning Gaza into a resort town. Here he is talking on Fox News yesterday.
We'll build beautiful communities for the 1.9 million people. We'll build beautiful communities, safe communities. Could be five, six, could be two. But we'll build safe communities a little bit away from where they are, where all of this danger is. In the meantime, I would own this. Think of it as a real estate development for the future. It would be a beautiful piece of land.
Would the Palestinians no have big the right money to return? Spent.
No, they wouldn't, because they're going to have much better housing, much better. In other words, I'm talking about building a permanent place for them, because if they have to return now, it'll be years before you could ever. It's not habitable. It would be years before it could happen. I'm talking about starting to build, and I think I could make a deal with Jordan. I think I could make a deal with Egypt. You know, we give them billions and billions of dollars a year.
Donald Trump with his freewheeling proposals for the future of Gaza. We will speak after one today to the Palestinian ambassador to Ireland with her response to the president's latest comments. But however you cut it, the actions of Donald Trump in the past 3 weeks are anything but normal. And many think the chaos that follows in his wake is entirely deliberate. He seems to be following the mantra of the tech billionaires now lining up to support him. Move fast and break things. What's next? Well, in 5 weeks' time, it'll be St. Patrick's Day, which has traditionally been a chance for Irish and Northern Irish politicians to get into the White House and develop a closer relationship with the American government. Will that even happen this year? The Taoiseach says he will go if he is invited, but the Southern papers are reporting that he has not yet received an invitation. And if that annual moment of unique access does happen this year, should Northern Ireland's political leaders go? The MP Claire Hannah is leader of the SDLP, which boycotted last year's White House reception. She joins me now. Claire, good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
Will your party be there if this happens and you're invited?
No, we won't be going to Washington this year. You said yourself in the introduction, this is anything but normal, and we don't believe we can attend a celebration in this context. I think it's supposed to be a celebration of Ireland and Irishness, and I think people here have made their views and their hopes and their fears for the Palestinian people in particular very, very clear. So I can't in good conscience go over and pretend that this is normal. It's just not in line with the SDLP's values.
Your party, of course, is not in the government in Northern Ireland, is not in the executive. You lead the opposition in Stormont. But if you were in the executive, would you have to have a different approach to this? Would you be there if you were in the executive?
Well, look, I'm speaking for the SDLP, and as I say, in line with our values. I think it's worth saying there is a different diplomatic role for the sovereign government, and mentioned the Taoiseach there, and I suppose his duties. I don't, and I'm not going to speak for the executive, obviously. In fact, I was asked this last year when we also didn't go in the context of the US arming Israel in their bombardment of Gaza, and we gave a little bit of latitude. Last year, I was asked directly about the First Minister. As you'll remember, it was the honeymoon period, and I think we all hoped they would go over and take some advantage of the dual market access. And I said I understood that. I think it is different this year. I don't think the executive have leaned into that proposition. They haven't. There's barely a mention of dual market access in the programme for government. They haven't tooled up the investment agencies. There hasn't been a big move on skills. So I think they did a really positive photo opportunity last year with the First Ministers, and I think people liked it. But if it's the same pitch, then personally it wouldn't be for me.
I wonder if you can just say that much and stop there, because as I say, you were also the party of opposition, leading the opposition in Stormont. There's an outlay of taxpayers' money to attend this kind of event for Stormont ministers, and it is a policy decision to be there or not to be there. So I think it's reasonable to expect the opposition party to have a view on that. Should they be there?
Well, look, we'll certainly scrutinise those costs. I mean, there are costs of doing business that we accept, but you do have to weigh up the value, and we believe the ethics. I'm a politician. I lead a political party, and I'm making a political decision in line with our ethics. There are legitimate questions about costs and travel. It's fair to say when we were going, if we were going, we would be going on our own dime. But we will, of course, scrutinise those facts. Again, it's about your values. It's about standing with the people who are going to be affected and have already been affected by this very, as you said, abnormal US administration.
I'm not speaking simply about the cost of it and whether you scrutinise the price of a business class ticket or something like that. I'm asking you if you think it would be wrong for the Stormont executive ministers to be in this particular White House, given what's happened in the past 3 weeks. I mean, that is a political decision that they would have to take to be there. They would be symbolically representing the people of Northern Ireland. They would be engaging directly with the Trump administration if they get that invitation. As an opposition leader in Stormont, what is your opposition leader colleague going to be saying in Stormont about this?
And you'll hear from Matthew, but I've made the decision on behalf of our political party in line with our values, and I'm very comfortable with
but
it.
But don't your values go as far as expressing a scrutinising view on whether it's right for the Stormont executive ministers to be there?
There's no doubt that will be discussed, I'm sure, in the chamber and out as others make their intentions clear over the coming weeks. I've been very clear about, as I say, our ethical approach to this. About, as you say, I think people here have got in the majority a view and an anxiety about what's happening, not just in Palestine, but further afield. As I say, I do in some ways differentiate between the sovereign state and the diplomatic role. But for a lot of other politicians, it's a glass clinking opportunity. And I'll say, William, in other circumstances, I'd love to be there. And it is it's a political opportunity. The SDLP is a party based on dialogue and engagement. For decades, we have harnessed the positive power of the US, and it has had a positive influence here in terms of inward investment, in terms of helping with dialogue. And we will continue to build those friendships, particularly with those who are actively resisting what is unfolding. I was in the US, I was in Washington last year. I am likely to be having an engagement with a university later on this year. We're not saying that you abandon the US and you never speak again in that regard. And we appreciate that there are complex and intricate economic issues. But this is, as I say, it's a glass-clinking opportunity. Most of the people outside, as I say, the head of a sovereign government, and I appreciate the Irish foreign policy is based on, you know, decades around this opportunity. People are in the, as in the Thick of It movie, most people there are meeting in the room, William, and as I say, I don't believe, I couldn't muster up the party feeling myself, given all that's going on and the words and the deeds that are unfolding day by day from this US administration. And as I say, I would question those who think that it is something that the people they represent would wish them to do.
So going there would not be consistent with your values as a party. In other words, you believe it would be unethical for you to be there as members of your party.
At a party, and I think it's important to say, and I have been.
But if it's unethical for you to be there, why would it be ethical for the Stormont ministers to be there?
William, you've asked me that three or four times, and I've told you I've made a political decision on behalf of the Social Democratic and Labour Party, and it's for others to weigh up the political opportunities for themselves and what they think are their duties in terms of representing their constituents. As I say, we haven't sought at any point, we've given principled leadership and tried to give voice to the views of people around issues relating to Donald Trump, around issues relating to the conflict and bombardment in Gaza. And we've done that at every platform we've had available to us. We've never sought to make it a political football or any sort of a purity test, but we have used all of the opportunities we have in Stormont, in Westminster, and elsewhere. And I know people will say, and it is, I appreciate this is a symbolic stand, but I know people, many, many people every day are raising this issue with me. They're seeking ways in their everyday life to express their concern, and this is ours.
Claire, no doubt your party can do as it wishes on this. I'm not particularly interested in that. I'm interested in the government of Northern Ireland and whether they should be there or not. And your party, but I'm also interested in the role of the opposition here, which is not simply to say, "Oh, it's a matter for yourselves," right? The role of the opposition surely is to say, "Go there, look him in the eye, and tell him X, Y, and Z, or don't go at all. Have a view." What is the role of the opposition on that?
I don't believe that there is a great amount of direct engagement. As I say, there are wider issues. And last year, people said, oh, what does it matter? And we spoke to, and we're published in the Washington Post and the New York Times, as well as media across this island, about our decision. So there was an opportunity to raise awareness. As I say, as far as I'm aware, other than the Taoiseach, it is glass clinking and selfie opportunities rather than a meaningful political engagement where people can, if they chose to, raise in depth the concerns of the people we represent. I don't believe that opportunity is there or will be taken or is worth endorsing, and it is an endorsement, or worth endorsing this U.S. administration, which, as you said so eloquently in your introduction, has caused such havoc in 21 days, and is really taking what was a terrifying genocide and moved very clearly into ethnic cleansing, alongside scrapping of USAID, the taking over Treasury payment systems, any number of other terrifying moves, many of them, as we discussed last week, William, seemingly for the financial betterment of some of his grifter pals. And as I say, I don't see how people could go over and pretend this is normal and have the crack and you know, raise the glasses and all of that.
In their new DUP podcast, the DUP have a new podcast, it's called The Lion's Roar. Sammy Wilson is in conversation with the DUP leader, Gavin Robinson. And Sammy Wilson says there that he thinks the Irish government is panicked by the new US administration under Donald Trump. And he says the Republic is so dependent on US investment. He says he loves the way Donald Trump does government. Do you agree that the Irish government is currently in panic mode?
Well, I think we can file that alongside the DUP's pronouncements that they'd done Ireland over and done Varadkar over. You know, these mystic megs of politics and the economy who walked our region into a total Brexit mess. So I think people can, in fact, I think Doug Beattie had it right in his description of Sammy Wilson yesterday. Look, like I say, there's no doubt. I think a lot of people are watching and waiting to see because it's such an erratic government. And I have seen Irish diplomats at their best, and I've seen them while they try to navigate the UK's Trump light period here. I'm in London at the moment, but here during the Johnson and Truss period. And you don't just, when people are bullying and throwing their weight around and subverting both international law and the economy, you don't just choke it down. They handle it with skill. It's also worth saying that the Republic have for years not just relied on, you know, bonhomie and paddywhackery and tax. They have invested consistently in skills and infrastructure, a lesson that successive Northern Ireland executives have failed to learn. And that is why it remains a successful, dynamic and open economy. So I don't think Sammy Wilson has any good record in analysing international issues or the economy. It may be that Trump is about to walk people into what the Wall Street Journal call the dumbest tariff war in history. And I think it says more about Sammy Wilson that he thinks it's whatever word he used to describe, that it's showbiz. And I think that says a lot more about him and his approach to public services and to the lives and the jobs of the people we all represent. You know, Mr. Send them to the chippy, I don't think really speaks for anybody as we navigate through what are undoubtedly turbulent economic and political times.
We've heard a number of people saying, if you look at various countries and the response to Donald Trump, now that he's become president again, people like Peter Mandelson, who issued all kinds of derogatory descriptions of Donald Trump, have reverse ferreted. Some say other countries have bowed the knee. They have grovelled to some extent diplomatically, and that Ireland is going to have to do something similar in order to do business with Donald Trump. Do you agree?
I think, as I say, I've worked closely and I've seen Irish diplomats at close quarters over many years. I think they're very skilled. I think there's diplomacy, but I also think there's sycophancy, and we've seen that from some others in the very recent past. I think Ireland has also shown, and as I say, I don't know exactly what the game plan is, but I think they've also shown a strong ability to speak truth to power over injustice and international human rights violations on the scale that we've seen. And I think they've taken brave stances in terms of calling quite directly and specifically out what they've seen from Israel and those who are supporting and enabling them. And I hope that will continue. And as I say, we tell little children and we tell countries, you know, the way to deal with bullies is not to just to take everything they give you, that there are smart approaches. And I hope that we'll see those in the weeks and months.
Well, often people say the way to deal with bullies is to stand up to them.
And I mean, we'll
rather than
see
to boycott
unfolds.
The meeting and not confront them face to face.
As I've said many times, if all those politicians who are going over to decamp to Washington are telling you that they're going to have a tete-a-tete with the President of the United States, I don't think they're being entirely truthful. As I say, I've been there in previous years, and the actual political access in a meaningful way is very, very restricted. Like I say, don't get me wrong. There are positive opportunities for people. Right. There are fundraising opportunities that we will be foregoing. But we think that's the ethical and moral thing to do at this time.
Just finally, we're turning right now to this report out today from the centre-right think tank Policy Exchange, which assesses the financial cost of legacy in Northern Ireland. They suggest it's in the range, in the region of £2.2 billion, and that is incidentally inclusive of already pledged future commitments. Let me get your response finally, Claire Hannah, to that. As an MP, obviously, you know better than I do
that public
spending is limited these days. So many essential services are struggling. Can that kind of outlay for legacy-related issues be justified?
Well, obviously, I think policy exchanges, figures on this and everything else have to be interrogated. There's no doubt that there is a cost. And the sad fact is, William, that cost is increased because every little bit of information has to be fought tooth and nail for, and because we have failed to address this and to, I suppose, let sunlight be the best disinfectant and allow that information to come out in a way that doesn't involve court case after court case. If we had enacted Stormont House or the provisions that are allowed for, we could get to that truth in a lot more in an affordable way. I'm also real about the fact that every pound we spend on legacy is a pound we're not spending on a current day public policy challenge, but we are going to have to deal with and address the issues and the squalid things that went on in this place. And the best way to do that is transparently and not, I suppose, put layer upon layer of secrecy and political rivets over the top of them. That is probably the most cost effective, and it's certainly in the long term going to be better for this place and moving past that awful period of our history.
Claire Hannah, thanks very much.
Call us on 03030 80 55 55. Text 81771 or email the programme talk.back@bbc.co.uk.
Let us stay with that new report on the financial cost of legacy in Northern Ireland. A group from the right-leaning think tank Policy Exchange, as I've just said, have made an assessment of the total cost of inquiries, inquests, court cases, investigations and the like, and also financial costs related to legacy cases and issues in the future that have already been pledged. All of this in the time period since the Good Friday Agreement, they say. That report is published on their website if you want to read it yourself. It's about, 14, 16 pages of it. And you will see there that they also tally up those projected costs to the measure of about £1.3 billion, totaling just over £2 billion. £800 million already spent, £1.3 billion still to be spent, totaling just over £2 billion. One of the authors of the report, the former Ulster Unionist councillor Geoffrey Dudgeon, says he thinks it is time to draw a line under the past and consider other ways of achieving progress, like amnesties.
Did the prisoners who were released after the Belfast Agreement, was that an amnesty or a partial amnesty? Of course it was. I reckon there have been something like 12 amnesty or partial amnesties since 1998, since the Good Friday Agreement. There were amnesties in the 1920s on both sides of the border. It's a standard practice of government to put the past behind us and try and move forward. And people are frightened here in Northern Ireland of the reality of amnesty. Some significant people have called for drawing a line, like former Attorney General John Larkin, and Dennis Bradley, and many others. But the reality is that one set of voices, for whatever reason, predominates in the discussion, so we're not allowed to consider amnesty. I understand that it's hurtful for victims who still want to see somebody convicted of the murder of their loved ones, but they know, and we know, and you know, that they will be out in 1 year, probably 2 years max, if they were even convicted. And there's been about 9 people convicted in the last 25 years. And we've spent close to £2 billion reinvestigating the whole matter. It becomes ultimately silly and absurd that we can't estimate whether we're getting value for money.
That's Geoffrey Dudgeon, who's one of the authors of this report, which, as I say, you can find on the Policy Exchange website. In the studio with me, the academic and author, Dr. William Matchett, former detective inspector in the RUC and the PSNI, and worked in special branch, also a member of the Malone House Research Group, which Geoffrey Dudgeon is part of as well, which researches issues around legacy. And with us here, Niall Murphy, solicitor, who represented a number of the families of victims and survivors of the Troubles here. Niall, good to have you back with us. William, good to have you back with us. We're talking about a lot of money here. That's well accepted, Niall. And I don't know where this argument goes in terms of whether it's justified or not, because you have to decide how the money was accrued, how it was spent, why it was necessary to spend it. Do you think this is a fair spend for dealing with the Troubles-related issues since the Good Friday Agreement?
Well, we are talking about a period that is almost 30 years. Apologies.
No, just sit where you are. You're fine.
Yes, it is a lengthy time span that we're addressing here. But we have to remind ourselves fundamentally in terms of principles that, of course, there is a cost to any truth and justice process. For example, when a crime is committed anywhere in the world, there is a cost to a police investigation. There is a cost in holding a trial.
Yep.
There is a cost in providing both prosecution and defence lawyers, court staff, judges. There is a cost for prison time if someone was found guilty and given a custodial sentence, and perhaps compensation provided to the victim of a crime. Is anyone seriously suggesting that we should not investigate crimes and that we should not follow the due process of law? This is an issue about access to justice. It's the price that in democratic societies we consider worth paying to show our support for the rule of law, not to avoid that responsibility. We must demonstrate disapproval of criminal behaviour and support victims of crime. And that's what we're talking about here, writ large, in terms of our recent conflict. Thousands of crimes committed by state and non-state actors over three decades. Victims deserve due process, have a legal right to an effective investigation, a right to accountability, and where the circumstances are appropriate, compensation. We know that there are many cases that were not effectively investigated at the time, and that's why we now have these long delayed processes taking place in more recent years.
So justice costs money, and justice delayed and extended will cost even more money. William, that's how you get to this figure.
Yep, it's an exorbitant figure, and I welcome the research, which I think is unique and a first. I think it begs maybe even looking at it on a different scale when you compare it internationally. You know, looking at the South Africa Truth and Reconciliation Commission, it lasted 6 years and costed a lot less. And if you take one inquiry here, which costing roughly 50 million, it's the same as 20,000 victims of apartheid. So when people say about, you know, you put a cost on life, and it's very difficult for anybody to put a cost on life, and it's something emotionally nobody wants to do.
No, but you can put a cost.
But it happens every day.
You can put a cost on legal processes.
Yes.
None of us are putting a cost on life here.
Yeah, but essentially that's what it is. It's like you're investigating it's usually a violent death, a sudden death. What is the cost? Not in South Africa, it worked out £3,000 per person. And it here at its top, it's worked out 50 million.
Mm-hmm. Do you think South Africa is the model we ought to be following?
No, I don't know. What I'm saying is, in an international context, so the likes of the 9/11 Commission lasted, 18 months into 3,000 victims of that terrible day. You know, Bloody Sunday lasted 12 years. If you were to translate Bloody Sunday inquiry to 9/11, 9/11 would last over 3,000 years. So it's almost as if here we're a world leader in doing this, and we're doing it to an exacting standard that I don't see anywhere else in the world in terms of cost and time. And it'll be, next, you're looking at the latter part of next year, the legacy, the peace process will have lasted longer than the Troubles.
Incidentally, look, there are some claims in this report, you can go look at it yourself, which might make you scratch your head a little bit, because, for example, it estimates the cost of a victim's compensation payment, which has not been agreed yet. It may be agreed in the future, but it hasn't been agreed yet, but it's part of the figure here. It estimates $500,000 for that. So there may be other things in there as you're going through this today, which you will want to put an asterisk by and say, well, how do you get that figure and why are you including that, given that we've been arguing about that one for years and we don't have yet an agreement even to commit to spend on it. Let's set that aside. It's a lot of money. We're all accepting that. It's a lot of money. Why do these inquiries take so long? And why do they cost so much? And the claim, obviously, Niall, you're not going to like this as a solicitor, is that this is as much as anything else a lawyer's charter. I mean, it's stuffing the pension plans of our solicitors and barristers with a lot of cash.
I would object to that characterization.
Of course.
And I think we need to reflect upon what the costs actually are. And if we look at the costs associated with the processes that the state have signed up to in terms of its discharge of Article 2 of the European Convention of Human Rights, and the delays that are inherent in those processes and in inquests, for example, the lack of cooperation from the state regarding the disclosure of evidence, with truthful accounts having to be dragged from the Ministry of Defence, GCHQ, the NIO, the PSNI and other state agencies. In recent months, for example, I have represented the family of Sean Brown and have observed the profligacy with which the state has approached its legal, financial and moral duties. 57 court appearances in relation to that inquest, which ultimately collapsed due to the approach undertaken by the Secretary of State, the MOD, the MI5, which in turn is costing thousands of pounds. Over 30 preliminary hearings in an inquest because state agencies refused to cooperate with the coroner. Mm. You mentioned Bloody Sunday there. That inquiry cost extra millions when the inquiry moved to London in circumstances where the PSNI said there was no security risk. Last week, for example, I represented the family of Kevin Barry O'Donnell at the Clonoe inquest. And purely with regards to the numbers of lawyers in court, state agencies were represented by twice as many barristers, with PSNI, MOD and former military witnesses represented by 12 barristers, including 7 senior counsel, 7 KCs, with the families only represented by half that amount. 6 barristers and 3 KCs. How much taxpayers' money was spent defending Dennis Hutchings, who appealed legal issues as far as high as the Supreme Court, a British Army soldier who shot a vulnerable, intellectually disabled man, John Pat Cunningham, in the back, killing him? How much has been spent trying to block the truth emerging about collusion? Things that might mitigate costs, the interminable appeals of coroner's decisions, High Court judgments and local appeals every time there's a determination which doesn't sit easily with state narratives. If the state had met their obligations under the Stormont House Agreement, a lot of these costs would not now be falling upon the public exchequer. And if the state didn't push everything into lengthy and opaque closed material procedures, which unnecessarily elongate its disclosure responsibilities, then the cost would not nearly be as much. The question is not what price justice, but what cost Britain's shield of sovereignty. The truth costs nothing. Cover-ups cost billions.
Okay. And I'll come to that, but the 9/11 Commission report took under 500 days. They had a budget of $3 million. It was so well written, it was nominated for a national award for literary quality. And it was a very significant bit of work into the 9/11 terror attack. And Bloody Sunday cost, according to this assessment by today's standards, something like £230-240 million. Mm. So even though you may be absolutely convinced of the need for justice, the need for an investigation, the need for an inquiry, the need for a full inquiry, and even though you might have setbacks, can you explain that outlay of public money, which is going to the inquiry incident? It's not going to the victims and their families. It's going to the inquiry to make it happen. Can you justify that in any way? That's a serious question. You've just heard Niall saying, if we didn't have the national security shield, if we didn't have so much resistance within government and within politics, you could do it a lot faster. I mean, that's one thing you didn't have a problem with in 9/11. Everyone was signed up to it. They did it, and they did it quickly.
Mm. I suppose this is still a divided society. And if you think about the cost to date of legacy, the big question is, has it brought any reconciliation or truth? I think one of the aspects in the report, I thought, which, remember when I studied this a few years ago, and a PhD, and there used to be something called the Legal Aid Rich List, or the top 10, but it stopped being published, as in, it's like lawyers, is what is the money being made on A, B, C and D? And it was always very interesting to see how that went. But it seems the greatest guarded secret in legacy is how much lawyers are getting paid.
Well, I think just to correct you there, that list which was published by the Legal Services Agency was in respect of the totality of legal aid which is dispersed by the public exchequer. Yeah. That accounts for family law, civil law, criminal defence before our present courts. It did not actually touch upon the cost of legacy. So I would respectfully submit that observation is irrelevant to the topic of...
That would include, for example, non-Troubles-related murder trials that were complex murder trials and the rest of it. Now, there is
take that point, but there has to be an element of it, which is legacy. That's what I was interested in, so I'm grateful for the qualification.
But what do you, if you're going to now, there are two different questions here. Mm. One is, should we have inquiries at all? Should we have investigations at all, prosecutions at all? And you guys in the Malone House Group take the view we should draw a line under that. We should go to amnesties. We should move away from that. But if that is not your view, if you take the view that we need those inquiries, we need those prosecutions, we need those inquests and investigations, it will cost money. What are we saying? Mm. We find some EasyJet, I shouldn't say EasyJet, let's just say budget lawyer, who's going to do the most important political and legal work for the people of Northern Ireland. Mm-hmm. Shouldn't we have the best doing it?
I think there's a lot of misunderstanding, even from what I see when I read legacy. There's a deep misunderstanding of how the law operates. There'll be a deep misunderstanding, and that'll include sort of people like Niall, who there's folk out there who don't realise that Niall's job is to represent his client and do the best for his client and present a legal argument.
Sure.
That's the way the justice system works.
And you used to be a cop, and the police can sometimes spend up to £10 million in one murder inquiry.
Yes, and I used to be a cop and have attended inquests.
Yeah.
And I've attended three in a day. And they were one was of a police officer and two was of UDR soldiers, and they lasted about 45 minutes.
Yeah.
And it was a local solicitor, and that was it. It didn't even say the cause of death was unlawful killing, gunshot wound to the trunk or whatever, and that was it over. And the difficulty, I wouldn't say so much as you're drawing a line in the past. I'd say
you're trying to even it up,
right? Because it's how many inquests has now been at, were there police officers or soldiers? Because there seems to be an acute imbalance, especially in the criminal.
Somebody's pointing out here, and I did mention this myself on air, so I guess that it's fair to read it out. The coroner's case we looked at last week had 21 barristers in it. Now, if you look at the front page of the judgment, it lists them, and that doesn't even include the solicitors, it's just the counsel involved. So there'd be different solicitors, different firms who will engage those barristers. But the various people involved in a case like that need their own counsel representation. That's why they're there. Mm-hmm. You can't just have one barrister for 14 different parties to an inquiry. They all need representation. You were going to say something now, sorry.
Yes, I was annoyed that William might characterise my practice in a personal way, but our practice has represented those bereaved as a result of the Birmingham pub bombings, the Guildford pub bombings. We also represented a survivor at the recent Kingsmill inquest, and fundamentally any legal practitioner will represent any person that comes through his door, and we do to the best of our ability. We have received instructions from many survivors and next of kin of police officers who were killed, and we're progressing those in whichever legal format we consider most appropriate to the circumstances of the case. However, what I would say, vis-a-vis the focus, which seems to have been drawn to more recent legal processes, that has to be set aside, a conveyor belt, really, of justice, which occurred in the 70s, 80s and 90s, wherein there were hundreds, if not thousands, of criminal trials whereby the law itself was distorted. Suspects were denied the opportunity for advice in a police station. They were held for 7 days. There is evidence now, as a matter of fact, that there were routine beatings which resulted in false confessions, the legacy of which is still unfolding before our current Court of Appeal. We had a bespoke Crown Court system whereby there was no jurors drawn from the jury pool to hear these trials, and trials were heard by Diplock judges sitting alone. So there was access to justice in respect of the vast amount of killings which occurred in those decades. What we're dealing with now is the legacy of impunity. And what we're dealing with now is cases which were not appropriately investigated. If one was to consider the historical narrative that might have been published in 1998, that historical narrative has now been perfected by judicially endorsed facts, by public bodies such as the Police Ombudsman and the HET, and the history of our conflict, if it was to be written today, and might not be written for many decades, would be almost irreconcilable with that which might have been published in 1998, because the truth has been perfected with fact.
Well, with fact, of course, these ombudsman's reports can end up, as a recent one has done, in the High Court, which has ruled that the current ombudsman exceeded her legal powers in finding that collusive behaviour. The term was collusive behaviour rather than collusion. Collusive behaviour by the RUC officers in a series of loyalist murders. And the judge in that case, Mr. Justice Schofield, said it was not her role, and she does not have the legal power to come to a finding of misconduct or criminality, or indeed, at the very least, misconduct. Even that is not within the powers given to her office. So I don't know where that goes on, whether there'll be another court case after that. But this can happen. You can go down the path with legal action, and it can lead to other paths off that path. We are talking to William Matchett, the author and former RUC, former PSNI officer, and the solicitor, Niall Murphy. We'll take a couple of calls. John Teggart is on the line. John, welcome back. Good to have you with us. One of the Ballymurphy family, of course. Good to have you with us. Go ahead, John.
Basically, you have to see where this is coming from and where it's getting all this airtime and throwing these ideas out. Policy Change is it's a pretty straight wing conservative think tank, based in London. So it's another strand of the what people call the conservative attitude towards legacy. And you have to remember, it was the Conservative Party who brought in this disgraceful investigative unit within the ICRIR, which all political parties outside the Conservative Party agreed with, where you had all the parties in the whole of Ireland against it, in which the Irish government took a case against the British government as well. So that's where all this is coming from. If you basically, for in layman terms, when it comes back to victims, we should be the most important people within this discussion. If we hadn't had an inquest, and the inquest for the Ballymurphy inquest was 4.3 million. Which lasted 100 days. But for us, all our loved ones were cleared, gunmen and gunwomen, including the priest. And the evidence that was put forward till the ICIRR, if we relied on it, that's where it lay, and that's where it would have stayed.
John, thank you very much. I'll put that to William Matchett. If we're asking blunt questions like, is this money well spent? And again, that's a very uncomfortable question to ask about people who have lost their lives or people who are survivors of terrible atrocities or their family members. But we have to talk about public money. John is saying, you know, how much money would it be worth for you to clear your name or your brother's name or your father's name if they're accused of serious wrongdoing?
Yeah, I'm not when it comes to go back to Niall, I wasn't impinging his character or his firms, is basically saying or trying to elicit that the majority of inquests have not been into police officers or soldiers. It's invariably usually been a state killing. I think the one is King's Mill is perhaps one of the exceptions. Where it comes to what price is justice in a legacy context, again, you look at, you know, what justice is out there. I describe it, a guy I grew up in the same estate with, Desi, two brothers. One worked for the health service, was shot dead on the Falls Road by basically a loyalist psychopath who later admitted to 19 murders. Desi had another brother who was shot dead coming out of mass in front of his family. Now, legacy, what Desi would look at is legacy will look at John. Mm-hmm. One brother to turn around and go, yep, okay, we will invest, we will take that on. The human rights groups certainly will take that on. But nobody will take on the murder of you. So there's a differentiation, and that comes into basically the politics of peace here. We have a political party will turn around and say there was no alternative to the provisional IRA campaign, which is essentially is to say, well, those what happened there, those 1,700-day killings were not crimes called murder. So what you have, you've a political party that's now discriminating on what is or what is not murder.
If you're speaking about Sinn Féin, they're not here to respond to what you're saying.
But that's the differentiation.
If a member of the public is accused of murder, we have an appropriate tribunal for that, don't we? It's called a court. And they're prosecuted and they're taken to court. But if agencies of the state are accused of something like collusion, conspiracy, participation in the murder of citizens on the streets of your own country,
yes,
doesn't that merit a public inquiry?
There was.
That's not a small thing.
There was police officers, and they were accused of murder. And there was a detective. You probably interviewed him here years ago, Kevin Sheehy.
Yeah.
The late Kevin Sheehy, fantastic detective superintendent, and he was part of the largest team of detectives ever assembled by the RUC, who went after a bunch of dirty cops and prosecuted them, not for a fake crime.
I'm not talking
called
about
collusion. They actually prosecuted them for real crimes, conspiracy,
yeah,
murder, and murder.
No one's suggesting that doesn't happen. I'm just saying, isn't it appropriate to have public inquiries when there are suggestions that agents and agencies at the highest level of the state were involved in the coordination or collusion in the murder of citizens on their own streets?
Yeah, I think when you use substantive evidence to put that, to submit that to an inquiry, yes, of course.
81771 for your questions, of which there are many. I'll wind through some of those questions in a second. We'll take your calls in 03030 80 55 55, and just get your response to this big number, 2 billion. How did it get so big? Is it a number that you can live with? And was it money well spent? And I think there's an important question here, which you've raised as well, William, which I'll put to Niall. And that is about the effect of all of this work on legacy in the lives of victims and survivors, which is what we really should be talking about, rather than, you know, solicitors, firms, yeah, and lawyers who, if they do a job, are entitled to the commercial fee they get to do their job. But what is the effect, Niall, on the lives of people who are in that system?
Well, from an emotional perspective, I would recount my last two significant experiences in court, that being last Thursday after the Clonoe verdict, and also on the 17th of December, just before Christmas, after the judgment in the Sean Brown judicial review, and the outpouring of relief from the siblings, from the children of those people that were killed unjustifiably, in terms of Clonoe was the phrase used by the judge. That relief is something that most people won't understand unless they have walked a mile in those people's moccasins. That is the value of justice. It's an ephemeral concept, but we do live in a rule of law society, and we do all have a equal right to apply to the court for their adjudication. And it's churlish perhaps to reflect or to comment upon the perception of cases before the court. All of those cases are before the court solely and exclusively because families seek applications to the court. And that perhaps should not be so. Article 2 dictates that the state should initiate these processes, but all of these cases that are before the court are there because of the emotional investment invested by next of kin, be that a widow, be that a child, or be that a surviving sibling. And when those families have the facts understood independently by an eminent High Court judge in those circumstances, that must be respected, because if we don't, then we cannot pretend that we live in a rule of law society.
Peter Lisburn says, all these inquiries eat into funds which should be used for today's generations. They are losing out on services because we pay for so many investigations into what we already knew. Not fair that people today pay for history. Of course, legal services is part of what people are entitled to in public services as well, isn't it? Mm. You're entitled to justice. That's one of the things the state offers you. Paddy in Andersonstown. Niall was right when he said the high costs are due to the British cover-ups and legal blocks. If they were open and transparent about their dirty tricks. Norman says it's a total waste of money, these inquiries. Look at Bloody Sunday's inquiry costing millions. We don't need all these inquiries. Time to move forward. Like, I don't know, we haven't had a referendum amongst the public on this one, William. I know that your group believes that it is time to draw a line and to move on and to do a kind of amnesty, as and you might say the release of prisoners was a kind of amnesty as well as part of the Good Friday Agreement. But that's not where the politicians are.
No.
And from what I can tell, it is not where the general public is. It's certainly not where most of the victims are, right? Mm.
Yeah, it's...
It's not going to happen, is it?
Yeah, I know earlier when Claire Hannah was talking about the Stormont House Agreement, back then, I think it was 2017 or whatever, the Police Federation took a stance that their members, serving and retired, were being discriminated against with unequal treatment and legacy via the Police Ombudsman because... The word collusion was only being applied to them by a unique form of justice where you have a criminal investigation, yeah, which people would understand as a detective.
And they brought that case.
And then on top of that, you have a public statement. So
yeah, but was that case, that case would then figure in as part of the legal bill assessed in this report?
Yeah, but the curious thing about that case...
Just pause on that for a second, because there's a certain irony to that, isn't there? That case you're talking about, yes, would figure in the assessment of the $2 billion that we're talking about. It's a legacy case.
It's a legacy case, yes.
Even the appeal of a legacy case is a legacy case.
Yeah. And it's well, and one of that one of those aspects, the Judge McCluskey actually warned the Police Ombudsman about appealing it, but it was appealed.
Yeah.
It went in. But the point
successfully appealed, William.
So the point being is In Westminster, you had two MPs. You had Margaret Ritchie and you had Lady Sylvia Hermon. And Margaret Ritchie was anticipating after this collusion public statement of Loughran Island, the second investigation, that she was hoping for prosecutions. Mm-hmm. But what the Police Ombudsman and the Public Prosecution Service, because a file had been submitted, did not inform the public or Westminster, was that there was no evidence. Right. They had found no evidence to actually prosecute any officer for criminal offence.
I think we're getting lost in the weeds.
No, but
in
this public statement was based on opinion, which Justice Keegan then went on to confirm.
No doubt, but it's way beyond the detail and the weediness of that is way beyond what we're able to
do. What I'm saying is it's a deviant form of justice and it was only applied to police officers.
But look, put it this way. Is £2 billion too much for 25 years of legal work?
If I could perhaps...
It's more leading, that's a certainty.
Address that and the first caller that you referenced...
25 years.
From Lisburn. Yes, everybody has to be concerned about the cost of the public purse. But what I didn't notice in policy exchanges hand-wringing about costs to the public purse was the massive public funds which have already been spent placating... the security constituency.
What do you mean?
£500 million was spent at least on the Patton redundancy scheme to depoliticise policing.
That's in here too.
£135 million of public funds was spent on hearing loss claims for 10,807 retired police officers, a scheme which was described by an independent government appointment review to be buckling. That was in May 2015. In the present day, we have the data loss claims, which arose from PSNI self-publicising the personal data of its officers, who will in turn be compensated from the public purse, which has already resulted in an ICO fine of £750,000. £250 million was spent on payments to the UDR and RIR, £20 million as a gratuity payment to the RUC Reserve, £106 million in the retire rehire scandal, bringing Patton retired RUC officers back into the PSNI without ombudsman supervision, and £70 million spent on a Patton style pay to prison officers. The collective price on those payments to the security constituency is £1.2 billion money spent. That's more than has been spent on legacy. And it doesn't seem to be remarked upon by the Policy Exchange, who themselves are a very anti-human rights think tank.
Well, I'm sure they would challenge that.
I've previously advocated for a withdrawal from the European Convention of Human Rights and the European Court.
Some of the reports may have done so. I'm not sure everybody who's part of it was founded by Michael Gove and Francis Maude. And incidentally, Policy Exchange has been criticised by a number of transparency organisations for the opaqueness of their funding on donations, which we can't tell you about. And they have been given in recent years, in 2022, a grade E, which is the lowest grade you can get in terms of transparency by the Who Funds You website. I throw that in the mix because some of you are texting and asking me about who they are and where they're funded from. Pete, and you know, when you look at these numbers, incidentally, and go and have a look at this report. I think I said it was 16 pages. It's actually 20. But look, the Food Standards Agency is listed here for £526,000. I don't know what that's for.
Mm.
You've got the Department of Health lift is here for 416. Actually, that's millions. I don't know what it's for. Mm. We've got a series of numbers which are all tallied, but you'd need to actually break that down and say, well, which programme was that paying for, or which programmes was that paying for? Here's Peter in Carrick. Hi, Peter.
Well, what do I do in my community really think that some of these legacy cases is not about legacy? I believe they're trying to rewrite what happened in the Troubles. And I just think, like last week, that solicitor done a nice statement about the families of the guys that get killed while they were on active service and how they'd be crying. But we have to look at our side. They're coming across there, and the machine guns and everything, they could wipe out everybody. And we're meant to have something. And that's not the first case. You've had Loch and Ireland where the guys with machine guns, and the European government gave them £10,000 as compensation. I had American tourists in my car last week when the story was on Stephen Nolan, and they were just amazed because they just said, simple, you run on something in America with a knife or a gun, they just wipe you out and there's no questions asked.
Let's hope we don't get there. Let's hope we still follow the rule of law here in the way that our police
shoot you and you can't shoot back.
Now, you watch some of these things, you see American cops and TVs, they pull somebody over, the guns are out, somebody's dead. This wouldn't happen with our police. We've got a higher quality of police than some of the stuff we see there, Peter. Thank you very much. I want to give Niall a response to what you've just said, because he was involved in the case, obviously. Niall. Pretty briefly.
Not to focus on the facts of any particular case, but in that case, it has to be observed that through all of the evidence which the judge heard, pathology, ballistics, witness statements, contemporaneous intelligence reports, the judge was able to conclude that the British Army had shot the four deceased as they were running away. Two of them were shot in the back, and then they were shot in the face. Those are extrajudicial killings. The evidence has been excavated. Truth has been told. However, justice remains extant.
Allegedly.
Thank you very much, Niall Murphy and William Matchett.